We walk west, we walk east. After lunch, we decide to take a walk along Tarbert Road, out to the west of the island. The sky is overcast and the land feels more exposed here without the shelter the harbour offers. The basalt columns rise like a pipe organ bellowing out to the sea below, and the wind pushes against our backs from the east, propelling us forwards. Kathleen Rain, a friend of the Campbells and frequent visitor to Canna, describes the landscape in her poem, which can be found in Margaret Fay Shaw's autobiography. To their grey heights they rise, the basalt crags, thus far into blue air, stayed where force into form no farther lifted, archaic columns of fire frozen to stone, temple where winds will sing, clouds gather, till sun and ice of summers and winters totter their rocky hexagons. I decide to experiment with singing at these archaic columns. Will they amplify my voice like a temple would? Will the sound bounce and echo? I have brought a handheld megaphone along in order to increase the volume of my voice a little. I enjoy the way its quality changes, becoming stronger in treble and more directional. Hindola horo hi ho, hindola la. Hindola horo hi hororoi, hororoi. I am able to use the megaphone to focus my voice on areas of the rock face, and sometimes it bounces back at me, and to Jeff and Susie as an echo. But today is so windy that the results are unpredictable, and the sounds drift with the wind. Hindola horo hi ho, hindola la. Hindola horo hi hororoi, hororoi. Hindola horo hi ho, hindola la. I repeat fragments of this song from St. Kilda. It is thought that the chorus made from these wordless vocables imitate the sounds of seabirds. The verses tell a story from the perspective of a girl who wishes she were out hunting for birds with her beloved. On St. Kilda, people's survival depended on harvesting eggs and hunting the seabirds that nest on the steep cliffs. As well as eating the meat and eggs, they would use their feathers for pillows and bedding, the oil from the stomach of the former for their lamps, and their necks turned inside out as shoes.
Hororoi, 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 hororoi.
A gull flies over our heads, wings outstretched, but there is no sign of the Manx shearwater. This bird, which Jeff is particularly fond of, used to nest here in the burrows along the cliff. But a few years ago, the numbers declined dramatically along with other seabirds due to an introduced population of brown rats. The numbers of shearwater dropped from around 3,000 in 1972 to only a few pairs in 2004. Since then, although the rats have been eradicated, it seems that there is now a new problem with a spectacular rise in the number of rabbits that inevitably disrupt the nests of this burrowing bird. I wonder if there are plans to reduce the rabbit population here. But as Jeff points out, these creatures are prime food for the few eagles who were reintroduced here after they disappeared. That's the thing with us humans. We try and make things right, to reduce the impact of our mistakes. But getting the balance correct is so tricky, and ecosystems are fragile. We are due to meet the property manager, Stuart, at the National Trust office to discuss the idea of developing the Away with the Birds project on Canna. The office is housed in an old farm building next to the harbour, and so we walk back the way we came, passing a group of dunlin wading in the shallows. The meeting goes well, and we're delighted that we can begin to develop the work for and with Canna. As we walk east for our second appointment with Magda, the clouds begin to break up and the sun comes out. From the road, the approach to Canna House takes us through a garden gate, up a gravel path, and through a tunnel of bushes that join together above our heads. It feels cool, sheltered and hidden. And we can hear the sound of machinery close by. Sure enough, as we emerge into the open sunlight, we see the figure of a man wielding a chainsaw, busy cutting wood. This must be Graham, one of the new residents on the island employed by the National Trust as a gardener. He's also an ornithologist, ringing birds for the British Trust for Ornithology, and has a blog dedicated to Canna wildlife. Our introduction is far too brief, as we are already running late for Magda, but Jeff and Graham managed to exchange some information about the birds they have seen this morning. Graham moved here with his partner Olivia earlier in the year, and I'm keen to spend some time talking to them both, to hear about their first impressions of island living, and about their growing knowledge and experience of the island as a wildlife sanctuary. Unfortunately, on this particular trip, I never get to do so, as the following day, they have to make an emergency trip to the mainland in order to take their dog to see a vet, who, as I understand, is now fine. We'll save it for next time. Magda welcomes us into the house, and we follow her and Pachu the dog through the dining room into the archive workroom. This tin-roofed extension was built by the previous owners of Canna House, the Toms, in the early 1900s. The windows face onto the garden, and in the centre of the room is a large billiards table, now covered in paperwork. When the Campbells lived here, every Saturday night in winter, the islanders would be invited to Canna House to play a game or two. John Lorne Campbell meticulously documented every game, listing who attended and who won. His notebook is full of the names of Canna folk, as well as numerous friends and colleagues of the Campbells who would come and visit. The notebook also reveals that it was often local man Ian McKinnon who won. What a great and inspiring way to bring people together. This room is also where Magda currently works, on archiving the Campbells' vast collection. In every available space, it seems, there are boxes and files of paper, which Magda started cataloguing with John in 1985. It was where they worked together, and it looks as though not much has changed, except for maybe the addition of a computer. Faded yellowing maps are tacked onto the walls, and up above, a stuffed capercaillie sits and stares blankly at us from a cabinet. This taxidermy bird is one of a few relics left surviving from a large collection that the Campbells inherited from the Toms, who were also the last people to hunt birds on the island. Although John and Margaret destroyed most of these moth-eaten birds when they moved in, this one, and a couple of others, remain as a reminder of a different era. The Toms, as Margaret writes in her autobiography, were interested in birds and kept careful records of sightings. If they didn't recognise one, they shot it to identify it later. Back then, if you were of a certain social class and you saw a pretty bird out walking, it was quite normal to just point a gun at it, shoot it, stuff it, and display your trophy in a cabinet for all to admire. These days, we still shoot birds, but with cameras. We sit down to watch two films, illustrating the life of Margaret Faye Shaw, intertwining her photographs and cine film that she made, and music that she played, with her story. Of Scottish descent, Margaret was born in Glen Shaw near Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania in 1903. Orphaned at the age of 11, she found conventional schooling a struggle, but developed her love of music, playing piano all through her life. At the age of 16, she was sent across the Atlantic to a school in Helensburgh near Glasgow. It was there that she first heard Marjorie Kennedy Fraser, who, although a wonderful collector of Gaelic songs, always sang in English. This encounter inspired Margaret to go and look for the real thing, to hear the songs in their original tongue. The following year, she began a journey around the Hebrides that would eventually take her to South Uist, for which she felt a deep affection. She said, "Of all the islands I'd visited, there was something about South Uist that just won me. It was like falling in love." It was on South Uist that she met two sisters, Peggy and Mary McCrae, and after hearing Mary sing, she asked if she could lodge with her in her croft house. From 1929 until 1935 she lived there, learning Gaelic and writing down people's songs and stories. It was also during this time that she started photographing the crofters, women and children working the land, and men on their boats. The material collected during these years was published years later in a book, Folk Songs and Folklore of South Uist, which is an invaluable portrait of island life. On one rainy evening in 1934, John Long Campbell walked into a hotel on South Uist and found Margaret sitting at the piano. That is how their romance began, albeit slightly awkwardly at first, but they were married the following year and began their lives together, first on Barra, then on Canna. We watched Margaret on the screen, playing her piano as an elderly lady in the drawing room of Canna House. She lived until the age of 101. The camera shows a close-up of her fragile arthritic hands playing the keys. A closing interview with her, however, shot around the same time, reveals Margaret to be strong and passionate, with a mischievous sense of humour. It's gone 5 o'clock by the time we've finished watching the films, so I make arrangements to come back on my own tomorrow afternoon to see more of the house in the archive. Magda invites Jeff and I to join her for an aperitif tomorrow evening at her home. Susie and I head back to the guest house, Jeff back to the caravan, and we arrange to meet later, for dinner, at the Gillabridge restaurant.